faced with a religiously inspired society determined to extend its influence over every technologically inferior civilization in its path, regardless of either the initial toll of conquest or the subsequent attrition of occupation, contact could either disengage and admit defeat, so giving the lie not simply to its own reason for existence but to the only justificatory action which allowed the pampered, self-consciously fortunate people of the culture to enjoy their lives with a clear conscience, or it could fight. Having prepared and steeled itself, and popular opinion, through decades of the former, it resorted eventually, inevitably, like virtually any organism whose existence is threatened, to the latter. For all the culture's profoundly materialist and utilitarian outlook, the fact that Idea had no designs on any physical part of the culture itself was irrelevant. Indirectly, but definitely and mortally, the culture was threatened, not with conquest or loss of life, craft, resource or territory, but with something more important, the loss of its purpose and that clarity of conscience, the destruction of its spirit, the surrender of its soul. Despite all appearances to the contrary, the culture, not the Idirans, had to fight, and in that necessity of desperation eventually gathered a strength which, even if any real doubt had been entertained as to the eventual result, could brook no compromise. Reasons. The Idirans. The Idirans were already at war, conquering the species they regarded as inferior and subjugating them in a primarily religious empire which was only incidentally a commercial one as well. It was clear to them from the start that their jihad to calm, integrate and instruct these other species and bring them under the direct eye of their god had to continue and expand or be meaningless. A halt or moratorium, while possibly making at least as much sense as continued expansion in military, commercial and administrative terms, would negate such militant hegemonization as a religious concept. Zeal outranked and outshone pragmatism. As with the culture, it was the principle which mattered. The war, long before it was finally declared, was regarded by the Idiran High Command as a continuation of the permanent hostilities demanded by theological and disciplinary colonization, involving a quantitative and qualitative escalation of armed conflict of only a limited degree to cope with the relatively equivalent technological expertise of the culture. While the Idirans universally assumed that having made their point the people in the culture would back down, a few of the Idiran policymakers anticipated that, should the culture prove as determined as a worst possible scenario projected, a politically judicious settlement might be arrived at which would save face and have advantages for both sides. This would involve a pact or treaty, in which the Idirans would effectively agree to slow or limit their expansion for a time, thus allowing the culture to claim some, but not too much, success, and provide the Idirans with a religiously justifiable excuse for consolidation, which would both let the Idiran military machine draw breath and cut the ground from beneath those Idirans who objected to the rate and cruelty of Idiran expansion, and b. a further reason for an increase in military expenditure to guarantee that in the next confrontation the culture, or any other opponent, could be decisively outarmed and destroyed. Only the most fervent and fanatical sections of Idiran society urged or even contemplated a war to the finish, and even so, merely counselled continuing the fight against the culture after and despite the backdown, an attempt to sue for peace, which they too believed the culture must inevitably make. Having drawn up these no-lose formulations of the likely course of events, the Idirans joined battle with the culture without qualm or hesitation. At worst, they perhaps considered that the war was being begun in an atmosphere of mutual incomprehension. They could not have envisaged